Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday. We'll talk about unexpected ingredients that make recipes special, things like cream cheese in chocolate chip cookies. First, even before the invasion of Ukraine started last month, Vladimir Putin was known for his increasingly authoritarian leadership style. Our next guest says he's a modern-day example of a strongman style of world leaders going back to Benito Mussolini. And Putin isn't alone. There are other world leaders following that path, and even leaders and other public figures in the Western world, including the United States, who see Putin as a role model. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry that the United States could go down the path of some kind of strongman dictatorship? Why do you think some Americans find Vladimir Putin to be an appealing world leader? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Ruth Ben-Ghiat is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University, author of the book Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present. You can follow her work at her Substack newsletter called Lucid. Ruth, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Before we bring things back to the United States, I want to focus for a minute on Vladimir Putin. You wrote about him a lot in Strongmen. I just wanted to get your thoughts on his latest actions, the Ukraine invasion, and the threat of a bigger crackdown and so-called purification within Russia.
Yeah, so from where I sit studying autocrats, I feel like this terrible aggression on Ukraine came about because Vladimir Putin maybe had intimations of his power waning, that he was at his peak. And when autocrats get into that stage, they get these kind of fantasies of grandeur, and Putin's very into the idea of reviving a version of the Soviet Empire and feeling safe with a kind of buffer zone, like he has Belarus and puppet states, and that was typical in the Soviet days. So he's following this kind of this fantasy, an imperial fantasy, and that's, he thinks, is what's going to guarantee him power, continued power. But as we see, it's backfiring badly.
Now, in your book, you saw an affinity between strongmen leaders in different countries and supporters elsewhere in the world. I want to give a listen here in the U.S. This is a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in October 2017.
Russia is our friend.
Russia is our friend.
Russia is our friend.
Russia is our friend.
Can you talk, Ruth, about the appeal of Vladimir Putin to far-right movements elsewhere in the world?
Yeah, I'm glad you played that clip, because Putin not only is the political and financial patron of far-right movements around the world, he himself is really on this kind of crusade to, and now he talked about purifying Russia. But it's not just that he wants to bring down American democracy or other democracies. He really wants to destroy the whole democratic world order and a certain model of civilization that comes with it, and replace it with this kind of repressive, with penalizing and persecuting gays and anti-liberal, anti-pluralism. And so it's a really kind of a global design that he has. And he's really sponsored so many far-right and anti-democratic movements, all the secessionist movements, including those in California and Texas, all kinds of far-right movements. Anybody who wants to take down a democracy around the world and establish racist, intolerant ideologies and forms of government are people he's interested in.
In the run-up to the invasion, I want to listen to a couple pieces of audio that were in the news just the week of the invasion, actually. First, listen to Tucker Carlson from Fox News. This is 2 days before the invasion.
What is this really about? Why do I hate Putin so much? Has Putin ever called me a racist? Has he threatened to get me fired for disagreeing with him? Has he shipped every middle-class job in my town to Russia? Did he manufacture a worldwide pandemic that wrecked my business and kept me indoors for 2 years? Is he teaching my children to embrace racial discrimination? Is he making fentanyl? Is he trying to snuff out Christianity? Does he eat dogs? These are fair questions, and the answer to all of them is no. Vladimir Putin didn't do any of that.
Then the next day, Steve Bannon on his podcast, The Day Now Before the Invasion, talking to Eric Prince, founder of the mercenary company Blackwater, speculating on the reasons people were opposed to Putin.
Putin ain't woke. He is anti-woke.
The Russians, people still know which bathroom to use.
They know how many genders are there in Russia?
Two.
Okay. That's all of a sudden. That's not. They don't have the flags. They don't have the pride flags outside on their.
They don't have boys swimming in girls' college swim meets.
How backward!
It's embarrassing.
How savage! How medieval! How medieval! This is why this whole thing's a scam. It's a total and complete scam.
So on the eve of this actual war, Ruth, a focus on, I think, culture war issues and the idea that in some ways Vladimir Putin they see as an ally in a culture war.
Yeah, they do. That's terrifying clips. And in the case of Carlson, who is an extremely dangerous man, who's a very skilled propagandist, takes a page from the Russian information warfare playbook, he's basically saying you have no reason not to like Putin. Not only you have no reason not to hate him, you have no reason not to be on his side. And Tucker Carlson has emerged as this kind of internal lever for, you know, any kind of anti-democratic, pro-autocrat sentiment. I mean, he goes and he broadcasts for a whole week from Viktor Orban's Hungary. And it's very dangerous. As for the second one, I mean, what to say? This, they're very clear about what they want, which is to, it's not just that the people have, there are only two genders. It means there's huge amounts of repression for anyone who does not, you know, is not straight. And Vladimir Putin has passed innumerable laws, as have other autocrats. I mean, anti-trans, anti-gay laws, anti-gay propaganda, as it's called, that are being imitated now in some American states. And, you know, what they joke about this, knowing which bathroom to use, but this is what they're erasing, is the real repression that people face in Russia. If you don't toe the Putin line, you're sent to jail or you're beaten.
We're talking to Ruth Ben-Ghiat, author of the book Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, looking at Vladimir Putin and his appeal and the appeal of strongman authoritarian leadership styles, even in Western democracies in some cases. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Ruth, in a country, whether Western Europe or the United States, with a long tradition of representative government, what do you see as the appeal of a leader like a Putin or other of the strongmen you write about? Why would somebody look at what we have here and say, you know what, I'd rather have that?
Well, sometimes people are led to believe that the alternative to democracy is better, and that's the destructiveness of information warfare, of disinformation, manufacturing crises, inflating crime accounts. But what the research says is that these kinds of leaders appeal when a society's had a lot of change. It could be gender equity, could be racial emancipation, workers' rights. And some people are overjoyed at this progress, and others see it as threatening to their way of life. And that's when somebody like we were very primed after 8 years of Obama, who was not only the first African-American president, he legalized same-sex marriage, gender integration in the military, women in combat, all these things that are progress. But many people felt were threatening, especially white males, were threatening their way of life. And so when you have a leader like and Putin did this and Trump, who comes up and says, I'm going to protect you, I'm going to restore your rights, I'm going to bring, you know, order out of chaos. And in the case of Russia in the 90s, it was true chaos and just terrible social disintegration after the fall of communism. But even here, where, you know, the Trump appealed to people who wanted to have some kind of making the nation great again, some kind of nostalgic fantasy of something better in the past. And that's what Putin's doing, too. It's the Russian Empire. It's the Soviet Empire. And these things are very powerful when the right a person who's very skilled at communicating, very skilled at propaganda, delivers these messages, we see it time and again that people fall for it.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat is with us, author of the book Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. We're looking at Vladimir Putin, his authoritarian government, and his admirers in the West, including some in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about her research on so-called strongman leaders and authoritarian regimes? Do you worry that it could happen here, something like a Putin-style authoritarian regime in the United States, or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, author of the book Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. We're looking at the support that Vladimir Putin has found in some cases in Western democracies, including the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see? What do you think people see in Vladimir Putin, even those who live in representative democracies like the United States? Do you worry that something like his regime could happen in a place like the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ruth, I think there's often a sense that something like that wouldn't happen in the United States. Russia has very, very limited tradition of representative government. I think I'm not overstating that. We've got a couple hundred year track record with some rocky moments for sure, but we're still here. Is it a worry for you that we could end up with something like that in a place like the U.S.?
What you said is true, that it's not going to look the same, and we would not have a Putin style autocracy here because we have very, very different traditions. It's more likely, and this is being set up at the state level through Republican legislation with voter suppression, we could evolve into something that's called an electoral autocracy, which is what you have in Hungary and other places, where you come to power through elections, but then you fix the electoral system, and we see that that's the focus of the GOP now, this assault on the election system, so that the results are weighted to what the Republicans in this case need them to be. So it's not, we don't have anybody. Putin came from the KGB, and as you said, there was this very long repressive tradition through communism, and a lot of what we see now, people are talking about this reemergence of a Soviet culture of repression. So we don't have that here. We have our own traditions of repression, of racialized policing and other things. So every country has its own repressive traditions, and we have the wild card here of our gun situation. No other country in peacetime has 400 million guns in circulation. Russia would never have to tolerate, militias and sovereign sheriffs and all these subversive individuals who now are represented by some GOP lawmakers who think it's perfectly fine. Like Matt Gaetz says, the Second Amendment isn't about hunting. It's about your right to overthrow a tyrannical government. And we had January 6th. So we have certain things that are very, very worrying. And so it's going to look different every place and every time. But what matters is you have a personality like we had Donald Trump who makes no, he does not hide his admiration for autocrats, and he makes it very clear that he wants that kind of power, even though it's not going to look like Russia.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Sarah is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Sarah, hello.
Hi there. This is a little strange comment, but I feel so strongly. I spent a lot of time on a social media site called Quora, and there's a I moderate a space about international relations. And of course, ever since this happened, it's like the trolling is just unreal. And I have to read all these things. And I really have noticed a trend in Putin supporters of pretty serious misogyny, and they don't always reveal it. But then if I look at their
Sarah,
comments,
I got you. Your line's breaking up a little, but I think we get the gist. Russian-backed trolling and misogyny on that social media site, Ruth.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that, Sarah, because, of course, Putin is the leader since Mussolini who engages the most in stripping his shirt off, showing his muscles, and this kind of hyper-masculinity. But everywhere, authoritarianism includes, measures to restrict reproductive rights, women's rights, but also police sexuality in general, like, you know, all of the persecution of LGBTQ individuals. All of that is part of this hyper-masculinity. And it's very important in terms of the threat. And a strongman, that's where he gets his name from, right, is a kind of a threatening individual who is above all other men and has a degree of control and glamour around his ability to have that control. So it's a very toxic notion of power.
Sarah, thanks for that call. We'll go to David now in the town of Raymond. David, hello.
Hi. Yeah, I've noticed quite a few pictures of Putin with both the Russian Federation and Romanov flag behind him. And that I hadn't noticed that before. And that was really kind of startling and frightening. That's kind of observation one. And my main worry is that people like Trump use democracy against itself to destroy it.
David, thanks for the call. First of all, Putin, he says, reaching back to the Russian imperial pre-Soviet past, Ruth.
Yeah, and many Russian analysts have talked about him wanting to kind of have a vision of imperial and imperious power that is like more like Catherine the Great, right? And so strongmen always channel nostalgia for something that was greater and grander. And you have Erdogan in Turkey talks about the Ottoman Empire, Mussolini talked about the Roman Empire, and so you have Putin both channeling Imperial Russia and then also the Soviet, kind of the power of the Soviet sphere.
And he also mentioned the concern that someone might use the tools of democracy to destroy democracy.
Well, yeah, and you could see what I mentioned before about developing electoral autocracy as exactly that, where, see, today you don't shut down elections. I mean, you have in North Korea and China, you have that. But today, it's harder to do that, and you don't even need to do it. So you keep the veneer of democracy going. You keep, like in Hungary, you keep some opposition parties, but you game the system. So what Putin has done, since we're talking about him, anybody who is really a threat or really a rival, like Alexei Navalny, he's in jail. He is not allowed to, not only is not allowed to run for office, he can't even be free in circulation anymore. And that's how they keep elections and the idea of democracy, but they actually, you know, neutralize it completely. And that's what all of the electoral manipulation on the state level right now and Trump's big lie, all of that is designed to do.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Ron in La Crosse. Ron, hello.
Yeah, I heard all these comments like this so-called pundit Tucker Carlson, some of these other people on Fox, and it seems that they will echo whatever the line or whatever attitude that Donald Trump had towards Putin. You know, it's unbelievable that some people would come out and defend Vladimir Putin after what he's done. And it isn't just invading Ukraine. Most Ukrainians think they're European, so it's an invasion of Europe. And yet you got these people on Fox and some of these other crackpots trying to, I don't know what's going on in their head, but all I say is whatever Trump thinks, they'll echo it.
Ron, thanks for the call. Your thought, Ruth, on the role of those media figures Ron is talking about.
Yeah, Ron, it's a great comment because we're talking about the Trump cult also. And it's really incredible. So there's a lot in the news about how Russians are just blindly following Putin, even though there's a lot of opposition, right? Thousands have been arrested. But think about what Trump was able to do in a democracy with a totally pluralistic, open media environment, and he still got tens of million people to believe that he won the election and that he's still somehow the president. And a lot of that is what you say, like Fox News, it's so dangerous. But they are just echoing what Trump is saying, but they also Tucker Carlson has his own agenda, and that's why he's going to Hungary to broadcast for a week, and who knows if he has political ambitions. But the common thread is taking down American democracy. And I find it incredibly sad as a first-generation American. I find the whole idea that there are these people who are just out to destroy democracy, and they're taking advantage of the freedoms to broadcast this poison, and it's just really sad.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute and a half, Ruth, your thoughts on ways to navigate away from the road to a strongman government?
Yeah, so you have to have a unified opposition. We need to construct a pro-democracy movement. And it's hard here because we're a really, really big country. And the other thing that's challenging is that other places have coalition governments, so all the other parties can band together against the autocrat. We have only two parties, and one of them has become authoritarian. So, but I also believe we really have to hang on to the fact that we voted out Trump. We did it. Biden got more votes than anybody in history. So we have to find that energy and that momentum to turn out to the ballot box and do the same for the midterms.
Ruth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Sure, it's a pleasure.
I've been talking to Ruth Ben-Ghiat, professor of history and Italian studies at New York University, author of the book Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present. She joined us for a look at Vladimir Putin and the support he gets in the U.S. and other Western nations. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll talk to a chef who loves to use secret, sometimes surprising ingredients in a whole bunch of different dishes and learn how to add those surprising items to our own recipes. We've already got a few recipes up online from our guest over at WPR.org/Food Friday. The recipe and the surprise special guest that appears in each recipe. If you have a secret ingredient that you throw into a dish, lots of dishes, let us know about it right now. You can email ideas@WPR.org or post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, some Republicans in Wisconsin say lawmakers should overturn Wisconsin's 2020 presidential election results. Assembly Leader Robin Voss points out that they can't, but made a claim of widespread fraud after a meeting this week. We'll get all the latest. Now it's time for Food Friday. Our guest is a chef who likes to get creative in the kitchen, really creative. Mayonnaise and garlic bread, cottage cheese and smoothies, rosemary and cinnamon rolls. We're talking about some unexpected secret ingredients that make basic recipes more exciting. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a secret ingredient that you use in something? In everything? How did you figure it out? Do you have tips for shaking up old recipes, making them something different? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kelly Senye is a chef and founder of JustATaste.com. Her new book is called The Secret Ingredient Cookbook, 125 family-friendly recipes with surprisingly tasty twists. Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
That's a mouthful, Rob. I know.
It is, but it really tells the story. I know what the book's about from that title. Now,
one will have any questions, that's for sure.
Well, I have lots of questions. Now, you've got kind of these counterintuitive things you wouldn't expect. Can you tell us about your approach to cooking?
Absolutely, Rob. So I am a mom of three little ones, and I have a fourth one on the way. And I think I speak for a lot of people, whether you have kids or you don't. We're all kind of getting these cooking ruts where we don't want to be making the same thing over and over again, especially with, the pandemic. It's like we're stuck at home, we're cooking more. So we get bored. I make the same three pasta dishes on rotation. So when I was developing the concept for this cookbook years ago, it all started with a secret ingredient chocolate chip cookie recipe, which you can find on justatase.com. It's been made by millions of people from every corner of the globe, and it is hands down the greatest chocolate chip cookie you will ever have. I don't know if you're a chocolate chip cookie person, Rob, but these are okay, they're soft and chewy in the center, and then they taper off in these incredibly crispy edges. And they're just the perfect consistency, the perfect amount of sweetness. And I achieved this recipe by actually taking a portion of the butter out and swapping in my secret ingredient, which is cream cheese. So it lends tanginess and moisture and contributes to a really great crumb within the cookie dough. And so it all started with that one recipe. And then that spun off into 124 others, which became the Secret Ingredient Cookbook. Yeah. So it's a really great way to use pantry and fridge staples. There are no weird ingredients. You're not going to have to go buy something on Amazon or track things down that are, you know, $32 for an ounce of a spice. It's all ordinary stuff, but just used in really creative new ways.
Yeah, for each recipe in the book, now you've got the recipe and then you note what the secret out of the ordinary ingredient is. Now I'm trying to picture your method here, and in my head you're just like, okay, I'm gonna make this stew. Well, I'm gonna try allspice. No, bacon. No, collard greens. No, you're just going through the alphabet. I assume you've got a more systematic approach than randomly trying stuff though, right?
So as a professional chef, so we learned, like when I was in culinary school and worked in test kitchens, like you just, your palate develops. And then you also start to see like there's patterns within ingredients and things that maybe the average home cook wouldn't pick up on, but like, you know, introducing pistachios instead of walnuts or like just, it started with small tweaks, but, I have to say, Rob, these were not all home runs. The biggest thing about the book, which I'm crazy about on my site as well, is everything is tested. All of these recipes were actually tested by home cooks across the country to make sure that they could be replicated 10 out of 10 times and you achieve the exact same result. Because I'm a big believer, if you spend time and money on ingredients and making a recipe, it has to work. So that being said, we had a lot of comical failures. Probably the most notable one, my dear husband, this was during the major like work from home era, right at the start of things in March 2020. I was in like hardcore recipe testing phase. And I'll never forget, he was working in his office and we were working on the cocktails chapter. I love cocktails. I love wine. And I was like, oh, we are going to do a pickle juice margarita. We're going to get the salty brininess and it's going to complement like the smokiness of the mezcal. So I make this cocktail and I was like, I'm not going to try it. I'm just going to run him a taste. It was 8:30 in the morning, not exactly cocktail time. And so I just had a straw full of this liquid and he was on a conference call and I was like, open your mouth. And he squirted it into his mouth and he starts gagging. So he has to put his call on mute. He's like, that is, I won't say the exact words, but he's like, that was horrific. And so I was like, okay, note to self, that one's not going to make it into the book. So it was a lot of trial and error, which was super fun. And as a chef, you're always looking for fun new combinations. So it was really fun to come up with these recipes. And these 125 are like the best of the best. I have a whole rejects folders of recipes that were fantastic, but just didn't make the cut.
Talking to Kelly Senier on this week's edition of Food Friday. Her new cookbook is called The Secret Ingredient Cookbook, 125 family-friendly recipes with surprisingly tasty twists. That gag-inducing margarita, not one of the 125 recipes. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Oh, she just dropped as we were going to. Kathy, where'd you go? Well, we've got a comment, though, from Chris in Adams, who says, try using red and white balsamic vinegar instead of just regular wine vinegar. Those are things I do like to use. And as it happens, one of the recipes you gave to us is a dessert with balsamic vinegar, strawberry galette with whipped cream. What's the balsamic vinegar doing there, Kelly?
Oh my gosh, you could not have highlighted a more perfect recipe. I'm a major sweet tooth person. You make this galette and there's actually fresh rosemary in the galette dough. Galettes are super easy. I always say they're like a really unfussy, rustic version of pie. So if you love the idea of a quick, flaky, buttery homemade dough with fresh fruit that gets that like syrupy, thick consistency, this is the recipe for you. So it actually gets balsamic vinegar mixed in with the strawberries. And so you get this sort of tanginess that lemon as a citrus and kind of that acidic component doesn't provide. But it's like just elevates it. And strawberry and balsamic is such a great combination. Totally unexpected, but that is top three favorite recipes in the whole book for me. And that rosemary, get a hint of that earthiness. It's so good. It is a home run, especially as we head into berry season.
Okay, now we've got Kathy in Catawba. Kathy, hi.
Hi. My secret ingredient is so simple, I feel almost embarrassed calling about it. But It's a coleslaw mix that you buy, like, from a bulk food store. You're supposed to mix it with salad dressing and when you make coleslaw, but it's got a little bit of sugar and a little bit of salt and a little bit of other spices in it. And I use it in soups and vegetables, even in, like, scrambled eggs.
Oh.
And years ago, my uncle taught me that anytime you cook anything with tomatoes, you use a little sugar.
Okay, a couple ideas there, Kathy. Thanks for that. Let's start with that second one, tomatoes and sugar. I think I'm seeing a theme here, Kelly, something acidic and something sweet with it.
Balancing that flavor profile. Exactly, Robin. That's kind of that's like lesson one, day one in culinary school is all about finding balance within taste and within those different flavors. So it's interesting she mentioned sugar with the tomatoes. So like when you're making a homemade marinara sauce, adding sugar is a great way to kind of offset some of that strong acidity that the tomatoes give off. And so I actually have a recipe in the Secret Ingredient Cookbook that's for my penne arrabbiata, but the secret ingredient is strawberries. So you get this combination of fresh tomatoes and fresh strawberries, and the natural sweetness from the berries elevates the flavor. You get a little bit of heat from crushed red pepper, and then that natural pectin too from the fruit helps thicken the sauce. So it's a slow simmer tomato sauce made with tomatoes and strawberries, and it is incredible and out of this world.
Thanks again for that call, Kathy, at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Aaron now in Salem. Aaron, hello.
Hello, good afternoon. So some people may have heard of this before, and my kids certainly love our secret ingredient chocolate cake. It's got pureed beets, and I'm a big gardener, so I've got beets on hand in the summer. I puree that and freeze it, so when everybody wants a birthday cake, they get the secret ingredient chocolate cake with pureed beets.
All right, I got to ask, Aaron, because I'm the lone beet enthusiast in my household. Nobody else will touch them. Are they really that stealthy, or are you really going to taste the beet in this chocolate cake?
No, you don't. I mean, it adds an earthiness to it, but you really don't notice it. The chocolate is a complimentary flavor, and it's
excellent.
Very good. And, of course, it adds a little bit of fiber. The other thing that I like to sneak in that my wife knows is my secret ingredient is I put liquid smoke in a lot of different things, including caramel espresso bars.
Ooh, that sounds really good. Aaron, thanks a lot for that call. So the stealth veggies in desserts, Kelly, what do you think?
I love that idea. So when having little ones, like you're trying to squeeze in veggies whenever you can, right? So I'm all about it. And I really love the liquid smoke idea too, that Aaron just mentioned. My mom, Noni, does these incredible baby back ribs. Obviously liquid smoke is a great ingredient for those, but it has such an intense, powerful flavor. I mean, a little bit goes a long ways, but I absolutely love it. But yeah, I do scones with shredded zucchini and chocolate chips to get a little bit of, more veggies in there. There's a ton of, bananas and peanut butter sandwiches. So peanut butter cookie sandwiches, I should say. So there's a ton of ways to kind of get fruits and veggies in there in creative ways too.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Chef Kelly Senier about her new book, The Secret Ingredient Cookbook, featuring lots of recipes with, yes, secret ingredients. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you make something that has a twist, an unexpected item that shows up in maybe an otherwise pretty common recipe? Why do you do it? Where'd you learn it? What does it do for the final product? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can find recipes from Kelly over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Chef Kelly Senier about her secret ingredient cookbook, where every recipe has a surprise guest ingredient. You can join in with yours at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kelly, before we go back to our callers, we've got a recipe here that includes champagne, and it is not in the cocktail section. You gave us a pancakes with strawberry syrup. Where does the champagne get into the picture?
Absolutely. So and you're picking all the highlights here. This is great. So pancake batter, the key is you want something light and bubbly that helps aerate the batter. When you're making tempura batter, which is a Japanese batter, you add club soda. So anything with carbonation helps lighten the batter and make it really crispy and crunchy. Well, we don't want super crispy and crunchy for pancakes. We still want them to be tender. So you actually add a bit of champagne to the pancake batter, and then you can have a little bit left over for mimosas then. So it helps to lighten the batter. Champagne also has a very yeasty undertone in terms of flavor. So it almost makes them taste like sourdoughy, but without all the time and stress it takes to baby a sourdough starter. So champagne and a pancake batter, I'm telling you, it works.
You can find that recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Lynn is with us in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi.
Hi. I've never been on the radio before.
Well, congratulations. You're on now. What do you want to share with us, Lynn?
Hey, my kids love lasagna. And whenever I make lasagna, if I'm going to use 1 pound of ground beef, I do 1 pound of shredded carrots. And I saute them along with the onions and the ground beef and then make tomato sauce. And I get carrots in my kids.
Excellent. And does it change the flavor much, Lynn?
Not at all. It pairs so nicely with ground beef. You can do it in like chili or anything that's like with a tomato sauce kind of thing. If you're using ground beef, use 1 pound of carrots. That's just a given in my family. And they love it. They love it. They love it. Lynn, and they share it with their friends, and it's great.
Thanks so much, Lynn. That's an interesting one, Kelly. Ground carrots with our ground beef and things like lasagna.
I love that idea because carrots also have a natural sweetness and can really get disguised as like a meatier, earthier flavor. So that's brilliant. I'm going to write that down. Book number two.
Thanks for that call, Lynn, at 800-642-1234. Before we check out another recipe, Kelly, let's talk about just kind of your philosophy. How can we do this at home in our kitchens? Do you have thoughts on how we can quest for that unique twist on a recipe on our own?
Absolutely. So I would say to just take a good look at your spice cabinet. Spices are a great place to start. A lot of times we find that we have even more spices than we know about. My spice drawer is a hot mess. It's a cluttered mess of I don't know what. But in writing and developing all the recipes for the book, it really gave me a chance to kind of explore some of those spices that I didn't use on an everyday basis, but are still really common, like ground cinnamon or allspice. I made a roasted tomato salsa that's in the book, and I used allspice in it. And it just adds a certain level of spiciness, honestly, and just this kind of earthy undertone that pairs so well with tomatoes. Same thing with cinnamon and curry powder. I do a crab rangoon with curry powder, which is really fun. So just kind of start in the spice drawer. Don't get overwhelmed by it and just kind of tweak things. You know, if a recipe calls for cinnamon, try allspice. Kind of small tweaks you can make off the bat until you get a little more confident. And then you can kind of go from there.
And then I think we've all had this moment in the kitchen, Kelly. This is pretty good, but it needs something. Do you have advice on kind of a diagnostic test to run to figure out what that
Absolutely.
Something is?
That's a great question, Rob. I love that question. And I would say, I think sometimes people are afraid to salt their food. I think unless it's a dietary thing and you're trying to go low sodium, a lot of times a quarter teaspoon of kosher salt can completely transform a dish. So rather than go crazy and adding additional spices and trying, you know, acidity and everything else, start with just a quarter teaspoon of kosher salt, give it a good mix, and then go from there. But acidity being said, some of the recipes in the book too, you'll notice are finished with vinegars or a squeeze of citrus. That's something I always encourage people to do too. I do a sweet potato and a beet hash, and it gets finished with a drizzle of red wine vinegar. A lot of times that punch of acidity after cooking, so you don't want to add the vinegar or the acidity while cooking, but afterwards brightens the whole dish, brings it all together. And then in that case, you don't really need to rely on salt as much.
Back in my early days of cooking, Kelly, like in my 20s, I think I was known, my signature flavor was bland. and the two things were what you just said, a little more salt and vinegar at the end. Those were life changers for me in my cooking.
Absolutely. Those two small tweaks will change dishes entirely.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Barbara is with us in Mundelein, Illinois. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I was just going to suggest doing with zucchini something similar to the carrots.
Yeah. What kind of things does zucchini show up in for you, Barbara?
Well, you can put it in a lot of things, cubed or shredded. And then also I make like a sort of a hash brown kind of a thing, but you have to kind of squeeze the water out.
Yeah.
But it can work.
Now, do you do like hash browns just zucchinis, or is it potatoes plus the zooks?
I just do the zucchini.
All right, Barbara, thanks a lot. Now, Kelly, here in Wisconsin, you know, we've got a lot of zucchini at certain points of the year. It's where you're trying to figure out how to use all the zucchini. Do you have a favorite thing? You mentioned there was a dessert that zucchini shows up in for you, I think it was. What else do you like to do with your zucchini?
Yeah, so I absolutely love it. And I, to Barbara's point, the whole big thing with zucchini is you want to make sure that you're squeezing out as much of that moisture as possible. So after you grate it, you want to put it in a kitchen towel. You would be shocked. I mean, a cup of liquid will come out of it. And obviously that really offsets a recipe, especially when you're using it in baking. But I actually have a recipe for cinnamon chocolate chip scones. And scones, Rob, are notoriously dry and unflavored. So I found that by actually adding a good amount of grated zucchini, that you get a ton of moisture and you really don't taste it, but you get these gorgeous flecks of green from not peeling the zucchini. I always like to think too, kind of visually what the finished dish is going to look like. So, and it's always fun too. It's a great conversation starter when you present something and you ask people to try and guess the secret ingredient. I mean, it's a great little icebreaker if you're doing a dinner party or even just cooking for your family. So they'll spot the green thing in there and say maybe mint or basil or I don't know. But zucchini is fantastic in chocolate chip scones.
Barbara, thanks for calling in. We're talking to Kelly Senye, author of The Secret Ingredient Cookbook. Let's check out another recipe you shared with us, WPR.org/Food Friday. People can check that out. This is a chicken cutlets with apple salad, and the secret ingredient is graham crackers.
Oh, yes. Yes. So my dad is from Budapest, Hungary, immigrated here in 1956. So Wiener Schnitzel was one of the first things I ever learned how to cook from my Hungarian grandmother. And it was a very classic breadcrumb breading on the Wiener Schnitzel. We would do either chicken or turkey or pork. And that breadcrumb mixture kind of evolved over the years, and we would use panko and Italian seasoned and everything else. So when I knew I had to include a cutlet or a Wiener Schnitzel recipe in the book as homage to my dad and my Hungarian roots. So I started playing around with different breadcrumbs, and graham crackers are fantastic as a breading in savory form, especially again, when you salt it after, right after you pan fry it, there's just a touch of honey and sweetness in them. So it really balances out the savoriness of the dish. And that one's paired with an apple salad. So apples with honey and graham crackers and this juicy chicken cutlet, it all comes together. And it's a great riff on kind of the traditional Hungarian one that I grew up on.
Now, you can't see my face right now, but this is the first one that's gotten my like, really? Kind of face so far.
I promise, like, these recipes were tested by so many people across the country. If there was even like a tinge of, but this is what I say, and I say it in the introduction in the book, like, trust me on this. Like, just trust me. I spent months researching and testing and developing these and feeding these recipes to my entire extended family and the home cooks that made them across the country and my poor husband, who was the ultimate guinea pig, for better or for worse. they have been tested very thoroughly.
All right, well, I always have graham crackers around, so I'll probably try that sometime.
Go.
All right. Was there anything you mentioned, the pickle juice margaritas as one that didn't work out? Were there any dishes where you found, you know what, these are pretty much just fine as they are? They don't need a secret ingredient.
I did find that a lot, and it's interesting. Sometimes I would like overdo it. You know, you're trying to think like, you don't want it to be gimmicky. Like, there was no point in making this gimmicky. I didn't want this to be like a make you search through your whole pantry and find something super, like putting black beans in, you know, pancakes or something super weird. I wanted everything to kind of pique the interest and then encourage people to continue making them. But I did do a fried, you have to stay with me here, Rob. It's fried rice pudding. So I made rice pudding. I chilled it down. I cut it out with cookie cutters. I breaded it with crushed up Cinnamon Toast Crunch cereal, which is my favorite cereal of all time. And then I deep fried it. And by the time I'd done this, it was like 36 years later. And I was like, nobody in their right mind is going to do this. Rice pudding is so creamy and delicious as is. Enough. Time out. This one's done, guys.
It's out.
The team. I was like, we're done with this one. It goes in the rejects folder, maybe another book down the line, but not in this one. Everything's got to be family friendly in like 30 minutes.
Excellent. Kelly, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
That's Kelly Senye, chef and founder of JustATaste.com. She talked to us about her new book, The Secret Ingredient Cookbook, 125 family-friendly recipes with surprisingly tasty twists. You can find some of the recipes we talked about today over at WPR.org/Food Friday. What do we got? The strawberry galette with whipped cream, the chicken cutlets with apple salad, graham crackers in there, pancakes with strawberry syrup, champagne, the secret ingredient in that batter. Again, WPR.org/Food Friday. Monday on the Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, call in to share the issue that's most important to you in your local community. Kate wants to hear from you. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. We were just talking about secret ingredients in food. Here's one that goes even further. A secret food ingredient in a diamond ring. Ranch dressing powder. Hidden Valley, makers of ranch dressing, commissioned a lab-made 2-carat diamond made of ranch powder that was subjected to extreme pressure and temperature in a lab over the course of 5 months. So they've got a ranch dressing diamond ring. They put it up for auction on eBay with proceeds going to a food relief charity. So how much was a ranch diamond ring worth to somebody? The bidding closed yesterday with a winning bid of $12,500. What do you do with a $12,000 ranch dressing ring? One, you can't eat it, or you shouldn't anyhow. Two, will it be an engagement ring? That's up to the auction winner and whoever they want to marry. But maybe they're more into blue cheese or Thousand Island. I don't know. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.